It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, 2019 saw another big drop in the number of dairy farm herds in Wisconsin. We'll talk to an industry expert about what 2020 could bring. First, maybe you felt the thrill of a runner's high, felt a little better about yourself after going to a group exercise class, or maybe just overheard a coworker talk about their tough mudder race. A lot of people find happiness in exercise, and the author of a new book says that people who are physically active are happier and tend to be more satisfied with their lives and are likely to be more connected and less likely to be lonely. Kelly McGonigal is a research psychologist, a lecturer at Stanford University, and a science writer. Her new book is called The Joy of Movement: How Exercise Helps Us Find Happiness, Hope, Connection, and Courage. Kelly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, a lot of your book is devoted to the concept that our bodies are designed to move and our brains reward us for being active. How do we know this is something we're kind of meant to be doing?
Yes, well, you can see it in everything from how your brain chemistry changes when you get your heart rate up in any form of movement. Your brain releases chemicals that make you feel better, less stressed, and even help you bond with others. But we can even see how the brain changes in terms of its structure, its physical structure, when people are active in a way that makes you more resilient to stress, that makes you better able to recover from even things like trauma and depression, and that make you more sensitive to pleasure and joy. So whether we're talking about that short-term boost that you can get, or whether we're talking about having a different brain when you use your body in ways that get your heart rate up. And the great news is it really doesn't matter what kind of movement you do as long as you are active.
And this all comes, you write, from evolution. Our brains were wired by the way our ancestors a couple hundred thousand years ago had to live their lives.
Yeah, so, you know, when we became modern humans, living in societies, cooperating, we also had to hunt and gather and work pretty hard in order to feed ourselves and our family and our friends. And in order to survive, the brain figured out how to basically create a hack so that when you are physically active, your brain rewards you. It makes you feel good. It reduces pain. It even increases hope so that you'll be willing to continue to put in the effort. And it also makes you better able to bond with others so that when you find that food, you're willing to share it with your neighbors rather than hoard it to yourself. And so, you know, even though originally this kind of brain hack helps early humans survive, we still get that same boost when we're active. And we are still meant to move because we have the same brains, we have the same bodies, only now, instead of going hunting and gathering, we can go to an exercise class or go for a walk with a friend or have a dance party with your kid in the living room and get that same benefit of feeling more hope, feeling less stressed, and forming stronger relationships.
On the flip side, a lot of people now have sedentary jobs like, I don't know, radio talk show host, where movement is not built into our daily lives. And it sounds like that may be making us not just less physically healthy, it may be contributing to a rise in anxiety.
I think that that's right. One of the most shocking studies I came across was they took people who were moderately active and asked them to become more sedentary for a couple of weeks. And what they found is that actually increased their depression and their anxiety and even decreased their sense of purpose and meaning in life. And so it is possible that the structure of our lives right now are increasing our incidence of things like depression and loneliness. You know, but the good news is it doesn't take a lot of activity to cross that threshold and experience benefits. So even if you do have a job where you aren't active, if you're able to make time every day, a few minutes a day, maybe, you know, one activity on the weekend where you spend an hour doing it, these are things that can make a huge difference in your mental health and happiness.
We're talking to Kelly McGonigal about her new book. It's called The Joy of Movement: How Exercise Helps Us Find Happiness, Hope, Connection, and Courage. Kelly, I think when a lot of people think about exercise, they might think about weight loss, maybe about heart health, maybe about looking better physically. You say we should maybe be focusing on this other stuff, maybe more than those benefits.
Yeah, I mean, so it is true. If you exercise, it's so good for your health and it will reduce your risk of all sorts of, you know, health problems. But that isn't always the most motivating thing, and it doesn't always lead people in the direction of finding the form of movement that they'll actually fall in love with, that will make them feel like they can take on the world. So I really encourage people to pay attention to their direct experience and to think about a form of movement that would feel good to their body while they're doing it, or that would make them feel amazing about themselves for having accomplished it, or that puts them in a place that's inspiring, like outdoors in nature, or spending time with friends or a community that you care about. And when people do that, not only do they experience more joy in the actual activity, they're more likely to stick with it and develop a relationship to movement that gets them all those physical health benefits down the line.
Yeah, that's a good thought. A lot of the people you profile in your book are people who have discovered what you have already, the joy of movement. There's a lot of, I'll say us, who think of exercise as a chore, something that we know is probably good for us, but we really got to get motivated to do it. You've worked with and talked to a lot of people. How do we move from that category to the happy exercise category?
Yeah. Well, so one thing you should know, the brain research shows that it takes about 6 weeks of being regularly active for the brain to change in ways that make people almost get hooked on exercise, so that you actually like it and you want to do it. And so one thing I'm always telling people is, if you can commit to something for 6 weeks, it's not just your body that's going to get more fit and find the activity easier. You will literally have a brain that enjoys movement more. So part of it is sometimes getting through that initial process. Another thing I encourage people to do is to think about movement that inspires them, rather than thinking like what's going to be most convenient or what's going to burn the most calories. You know, if somebody sent you a YouTube video, what's the video you'd watch? Do you love watching people cross a finish line? And maybe you should think about training for a 5K. Or do you love watching, you know, dance videos? Maybe you can find a community dance class. Do you like to see people do amazing things? Maybe you should go to a strength training gym and where they're doing, you know, flipping tires and lifting heavy weights. Often there's a sort of a part of yourself that movement could bring out in you that would be really interesting or exciting. And these are all ways to kind of find your way into movement. And the other thing, of course, is to do it with other people if that motivates you, because exercise actually makes it easier to bond with people. So if there's someone you want to strengthen a relationship with, moving is a great way to do it. And then the pleasure people get from that often allows them to stay with movement long enough for their body and their brains to get hooked on it.
One community you focus on that I thought was really interesting was a group, a gym that focused on adaptive fitness and exercise for people with physical disabilities, and in some cases, people with depression. Can you talk about that? Because there's some great stories there.
Yeah, so DPI Adaptive Fitness in Fairfax, Virginia was one of my favorite gyms that I visited. Everyone who trains there is a serious athlete in the sense that they are doing amazing things. They are boxing. They are, you know, dragging heavy weights across the floor. They are weightlifting. And they also, you know, have traumatic brain injuries or are in wheelchairs or have cerebral palsy. And what I loved about this gym is that people often set in this gym movement goals, like to be able to punch 100 times in 60 seconds or to lift a certain amount of weight. Or one woman who is a stroke survivor is able to do 1,000 squats in a row on a weighted machine. And in the process of achieving that goal, they're actually developing physical capabilities that allow them to reach meaningful goals in their life, like be able to drive a car or to walk. But at the same time, on that journey, they get to sense their own strength. They get to sense their own resilience. And that tends to create a lot of hope about every aspect of their lives. And the other thing I loved about this community is they bring in friends and family. So, you know, by the time you're ready to do those 1,000 squats in a row, you've often got your spouse with you or your friend with you who's cheering you on and taking a video. And it's just such a great model of a lot of the ways that great communities of movement support one another.
We're talking to Kelly McGonigal, research psychologist and lecturer at Stanford University. Her new book is called The Joy of Movement: How Exercise Helps Us Find Happiness, Hope, Connection, and Courage. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Has exercise changed the way you see yourself over the years? Do you feel happier when you're active? Have you taken a group fitness class? How does that make you feel? Do you feel connected to the people around you? Or do you think of exercise as a chore, something you have a hard time getting motivated for? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Kelly McGonigal, a research psychologist and lecturer at Stanford University. We're talking about exercise and her new book. It's called The Joy of Movement: How Exercise Helps Us Find Happiness, Hope, connection, and courage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you made exercise a regular part of your life? If so, what got you into that? Do you feel better when you're active, or flip it around? Do you feel worse when you're not able to be active for one reason or another? Have you ever had that runner's high and you feel like part of a community with people you work out with, you're on a team with, whatever your form of exercise might be? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kelly, I love another community you talk about in your book. I think this one was in London, where people run around, but then along the way they meet a special group of coaches that their gym sets them up with.
Yes, this is Good Gym. I love them too. Good Gym has two programs. So the first program is runners get assigned a coach who is actually an older adult in their neighborhood who's really isolated, maybe doesn't leave their home very often, and has asked for a companion that they can coach in their running journey. And so they run to the coach's home, spend time there, have tea, maybe help them out with some household tasks, and then they run back home. And people form real friendships and begin to feel quite integrated in those relationships. The other aspect of Good Gym is that runners also form running groups where they meet up in their own neighborhood, run a mile or two, and then do a community service project. So they might make a meal for people who are currently homeless, or they might plant flowers in a local garden, and then they run back to where they started and have drinks or dinner. And again, they're integrating their activity while they're with their own community. They're building relationships, and they're feeling like they're able to contribute to their community. And this just reminded me so much of, you know, as we were talking earlier about how humans initially got a runner's high because we had to go out into the world and find food and support one another and cooperate in tribes. And this is basically what Good Gym is doing. It's harnessing both the runner's high and the satisfaction that we get when we feel like we're a part of our community and we're able to contribute.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Tom joins us in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Tom?
I want to recommend to people that they adopt the Berkey lifestyle, that they choose to ski one of the Berkey races, and there's a race for everybody. That's cross-country ski race, Hayward and Cable area of Wisconsin. It is the most magical rush of a race that you can be involved in. It's changed my life. It's changed my complete orientation to winter. No longer do you dread the winter and the cold. You look forward to it. You embrace it. You lean into it. You long for a good, strong winter and lots of snow. It's a year-round lifestyle because you can never be too prepared for whichever race you're skiing up there.
And Tom, I want to ask, you sound like a convert. What got you out there the first time you did a Berkey race?
All right, so the first time I did the race was in 1984. I was an idiot. I had no idea. I got up there and got up that morning. They told me it's 15 below, and I said, no, I can't be 15 above. It can't be 15 below. Completely unprepared for it, and had a great time despite breaking a bone during the race. That's the thing. All these people, their first time experience is a disaster, yet they're completely hooked by the race, and they come back year after year after year. Ben Pop, the director up there, does an absolutely fabulous job. It really is a great Wisconsin institution.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. Thank you so much for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. That's the thing there, Kelly, that kind of exercise. And there's a lot of things to people who haven't done them, people like me, they sound a little masochistic, but as we heard from Tom, there's a lot of joy there.
Yes, I mean, I love, he said it was a magical rush. And I heard language like that from so many people who do activities that to me seem crazy or scary. You know, people who are running ultra marathons or doing these adventure races or doing a Tough Mudder obstacle course. And what I found is that often when there's an edge in activities like that, that really put you out there in the environment, that challenge you, and especially when you're doing it with other people, it has a profound psychological impact that can be like a magical rush, even when, you know, on the outside it looks crazy. I feel like the same thing is true with a lot of exercise experiences. I mean, I teach group fitness, and I feel like if you were looking, you know, in through a window at a bunch of people doing jumping jacks and lip syncing, it looks kind of ridiculous. But when you're in the middle of it and getting that endorphin rush, it feels like the most natural thing in the world. Sometimes you have to actually experience it to get it.
Tom, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. We're talking to Kelly McGonigal about her new book, The Joy of Movement, How Exercise Helps Us Find Happiness, Hope, Connection, and Courage. Still a line open for you if you want to share your story, the exercise that gives you joy. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Part of what I loved about Tom's story there too, Kelly, is that first race, he was probably looking at people zooming along while he's there freezing and breaking his bones. And it sounds like he wasn't swayed by that. He didn't worry about comparing himself. You might see people in your classes saying, hey, these people know everything they're doing. Or you go to a gym and see people lifting trucks, resisting that urge to compare yourself with other people who are better at it than you are.
Yeah, I mean, that's so important. Mindset can make a really big difference. And so if you can go in and look for the spark that you enjoyed some aspect of it, or you surprised yourself in some way, or you're maybe you're intrigued, like you couldn't do something and you had a failure experience, but you're really intrigued, like maybe I could do that at some point, to really follow that. And I also encourage people to practice what sometimes psychologists call sympathetic joy. It can be really exciting to watch other people succeed. You know, you can experience that at a race or at a gym, to cheer other people on. And that can be part of the joy of movement, is when you celebrate others. And we often get a big payoff for that, too. So you show up, you're a beginner, you celebrate everyone else. And often what you'll experience is that people love beginners, too, and will cheer you right back.
Now, we've talked a little bit about people getting hooked, as our first caller was there, on a particular kind of exercise. But on a serious level, you found, Kelly, a lot of people who do, especially ultra-marathon things, they see it as part of, in some cases, a recovery from an actual addiction.
Yes. So what's fascinating is that exercise changes the brain in exactly the opposite way that that substance abuse can change the brain. So people who've struggled with addiction as well as depression, their brains are often less responsive to everyday joys and pleasures. You know, drugs can totally wreak havoc on your brain's reward system. And exercise actually enhances the function of the reward system. It can even literally repair the havoc that has been caused by substance abuse. And so I did meet so many people who are in recovery, who didn't, it's not just that exercise is like a substitute addiction, it's that being active helped their brains recover from some of the most insidious side effects of experiencing addiction. And you can get hooked on exercise in a really healthy way.
Let's bring on another caller now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. Well, you've mentioned something, or your guest has sort of implicitly, but I still wanted to say it explicitly, that the half hour, the hour a day of exercise, I consider that an important investment for the other 23 hours of the day. You sleep better. You move more effortlessly through your life. You can be more agile, less aches, it just makes life overall a higher quality.
Tom, thanks for the call. Kelly, no argument there?
No, that's absolutely right, and the research backs it up. Two of my favorite findings: on days when people exercise, they actually are less affected by stressful things that happen later in the day. So if something goes wrong at work or your kid gets sick, and you're just less negatively impacted by that, you're able to handle it better. Also, people have better social interactions on a day when they exercise. That they report more closeness, feeling more supported by other people, enjoying other people more. And it's exactly right that exercise is often an investment. It's not just an investment in your health, but you will literally experience life differently because exercise changes your brain chemistry and changes your mindset.
Thanks for the call, Tom. We'll go now to James with us in Fountain City. James, hello.
Hi. Say, to make it quick, I'll be turning 72 here in a couple of weeks. I started doing endurance sports, actually started with a Birkebeiner, like one of the previous callers did, back in 79. And I did 27 of them. I decided to quit probably about 10 years ago, but I do other things too. And how a person gets involved in these type of challenges, I'm not really sure what triggers it. I think there's kind of an intellectual driving force that you instinctually realize that doing these type of things is good for you. And even though they can be phenomenally uncomfortable, to say the least, it just bodes well for my overall well-being. And so besides skiing, I've mountain bike raced, I've mastered swim races, canoe marathon racing. I just enjoy the challenge and enjoy the feeling and the friendship, too, with other people that do the same things.
James, thanks for the call. Kelly, you heard a lot of stories like James's, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's true for things like endurance events. People often have a curiosity, like, is this possible? What would it be like to try? And that's often something that drives people. And you don't have to be attracted to endurance events to sort of follow that kind of curiosity. Like, what might it be like to learn how to tango? What might it be like to, you know, to lift something heavy? I encourage people to follow that curiosity when like, you see something that looks interesting and you think, oh, I don't know, but maybe, and what if?
In our last minute or so, Kelly, you write in your book that you started off thinking you were writing a self-help book, and it turned into almost a celebration of the many different ways that people get joy from movement. Can you celebrate that for our last minute?
Yeah. So what I discovered in talking to people about movement is they often were their best selves when they talked about it. I got to hear about human strengths, like the ability to cooperate or to experience self-transcendence or to be resilient. And to take joy. What I realized is I basically wrote a love letter to human nature as well as exercise, because when people talk about what they love about movement, they often are talking about what they love about themselves and what they love about the people in their lives. And so this book is as much a love letter to the good that is in us as well as why exercise is good for us.
Kelly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kelly McGonigal is a research psychologist, a lecturer at Stanford University, and a science writer. She joins us to talk about her new book. It's called The Joy of Movement, How Exercise Helps Us Find Happiness, Hope, Connection, and Courage. Still time for you to share your story, what exercise, what movement gives you joy. Tell us about it over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, milk prices are coming back up some, but will it be enough, fast enough, to save dairy businesses and farms? An industry expert joins us to weigh in. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Cartoonist Charles Schulz created more than 18,000 daily comic strips about Charlie Brown, Snoopy, and the rest of the Peanuts gang. Coming up, we look at how those comics affected people's lives and American pop culture, as well as what they can teach us about life itself. First, according to new data from Wisconsin's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, the number of registered dairy herds in Wisconsin went down by about 10% last year. It's a big drop. It follows years of declining numbers of herds. Low milk prices over the last several years are part of that story, though prices seem to be recovering right about now. Bob Kropp is a professor emeritus of agricultural and applied economics at UW-Madison. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you.
Well, this 10% number sounds like a big deal. Is this
alarming? It is a big deal. You know, we have been losing dairy farms every year, 300 to 400. You look at the structure of Wisconsin dairy industry, we have about 35% less than 50 cows, another 32 between 50 and 99. A lot of small operations, people retiring out of the facilities. That's 3 to 4%. But in 2019, we lost 818 farms, which was 10%. The year before, it was 691. And as you indicated, we had 4.5 years from 2015, first half to 2019, very low milk prices. But a lot of financial stress on dairy farmers. And some of them went bankrupt. Some of them just simply said, I'm not going to stay with this. I'm losing too much equity. So we lost more than the 3 to 4% normal trend, 10%, which is quite a loss, yes.
Now, we see the number of herds going down, the number of dairy farm operations going down. Does that mean we end up with fewer dairy cows in Wisconsin?
Well, actually, from 2005 up until 2019, we increased cow numbers every year. But with that loss of dairy farms, cow numbers did go down. In fact, right now we're about 7,000 head fewer cows than a year ago.
So that's a new thing, because as I've understood it, some of this is consolidation over the years. This is something a little different in 2019.
Yeah, because we had expansion, larger herds going on, so cow numbers actually were growing. We needed more milk for a cheese plant. We ran into, actually, tight plant capacity there last couple of years. So cow numbers up, production per cow up, so we were growing in milk production each year, yes.
Now, I see out in the news, we've got Borden, the dairy company, filing for bankruptcy. We had Dean last year.
Yep.
And they're saying part of the problem for Borden is milk prices, raw milk prices are getting a little too high from their perspective. Now, what does this mean for an industry when, you know, a little increase, it was too low for the dairy farmers,
right.
It goes up and now it's too high for the dairy companies?
Well, what happens is, you're right, we raised the milk price about $6 a hundredweight from February to November this year. It's very difficult for these bottlers like Dean's or Borden's to pass that increase onto the grocery store. So it really affects their margins very adversely. They would like to see more of a stable milk price rather than up and down. But when it goes up that fast, it's difficult for them to pass that on to the retailers. Retailers put a lot of pressure and keep those prices down.
Now, for dairy farms in Wisconsin, where is most of their milk going? Is it ending up in bottles on the shelf? Is it turning into cheese? Where does the bulk of it go?
Well, good news in Wisconsin, the cheese industry is a growth in the dairy industry, and that's where 90% of our milk goes. And because of that, even though milk prices are low, you compare our prices to some states, our dairy farmers get very good milk price compared to, say, the West, like California or Idaho or Texas, yes.
Talking to Bob Kropp, Professor Emeritus of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. As we've mentioned, Bob, milk prices have gone up some. What are you looking at in 2020 now?
Well, I look for a much better year. Because of the financial stress, I do not see a big expansion in milk production this coming year. Normally, farmers, you know, price goes up, produce more milk. But with the financial stress, it takes a while to do that. We look for demand to keep on going, particularly for cheese. Fluid consumption keeps on going down. It even looks like there's some opportunity for exports. So we're looking at probably milk prices. First part of the year, average maybe $3 higher than a year ago. It's got very low prices. And then maybe about the same the second, and averaging at least a dollar or more for the year than it did this past year.
Let's bring on a caller. Tom is with us in Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Hi. I've got a question about, I'm part-time on a 60-cow operation. And do you see a point in the future where we get a balance between these large operations and the small operations? Is that in our future, or do we just go all out large farms?
Tom, thanks for the call. It's a question a lot of people are wondering about, Bob. If we're going to see just large farm operations, dairy farm operations in the future, or are we going to see a balancing point where we still keep some of our smaller operations?
Yeah, we're going to see. One thing about Wisconsin, you're going to see diversity. We're going to, you know, a lot of 50-cow going out doesn't mean there's no opportunity there. Some of them are grazers, organic, or they're selling to especially cheese plants that's paying a very nice price, and we have larger. So the trend will be fewer and larger, but they won't all be 1,000-cow operations. Still opportunities. There's a lot of 200 to 400-cow operations. You can have milking parlors, freestalls, where two or three families could farm together rather than one. So there'll be a variety of sizes. They won't all be large.
Now, I hear sometimes about issues of succession planning. You've got an aging population of farm owners, dairy farm operators, and in some cases, maybe that farm goes out of business, closes down because there's nobody to take it up when they retire. Is that something you're seeing?
Yeah, a lot of those smaller farms got facility. The barns are old, stanchions, and cow comfort and that. And if they're going to stay in the business, they probably need to build some new facilities. And they probably build a freestall rather than 50 cows. It may go to 200 or so. And maybe if you got a son or daughter who's interested, they may be more interested in a more modern operation that you could have a milking parlor and even go to robots now. Of course, the small farms can't afford those. So anyway, there's going to be that continual restructuring going on in the dairy industry, yes.
Now, sometimes when we talk about the dairy industry in Wisconsin, and we've seen some comments about this on our news article on the website, some people complain, hey, policy has balanced the playing field in favor of the big guys and against the little guys in the dairy industry. Is that something you see?
Well, that's not totally correct. I realize the bigger farmers get, some volume premiums on their milk, discounts and feed. They got some economies of scale. But actually, the current dairy policy we have, which is a dairy margin protection program where farmers can protect their margin or feed costs, it's designed really to hit the smaller farms, 200 cows or less. Really, they get a much cheaper premium than the larger farms, so designed to give more support to the smaller farms and the larger farms and the current dairy policy we now have.
I saw there's a small but a slowly growing list of counties in Wisconsin where there are no dairy farms left. I think it's just like four or something like that at this point.
Some of the north, I think like Vilas County, no cows left or something like that.
Right.
I mean, yes.
Can you talk about the impact that can have on a rural economy? If it's been a place that depended on maybe a handful of small farms as, you know, kind of the backbone of the local economy.
Well, that's true. I mean, they have more of a community, the smaller farmers and that. That's not to say the larger farmers are not involved. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of the larger farmers may have more time to actually get involved with some community things. But there's a concern. The smaller farms definitely are buying more local, supporting local businesses and that. And so there's a concern in the rural community as we continue to lose the number of farmers that we have.
Now, I've heard we've talked to some farmers who say, you know, they left dairy farming. They're moving into other specialties, crops, what have you, more boutique kind of things. Is that, do you see that happening, or is it people leaving agriculture entirely?
Well, there's a number of examples where farmers have tried to supplement that dairy income doing something else. There's one down in Rock County that's gone into summer camps for kids to come out, for example. Some are growing other types of crops. Talk about hemp. I'm not sure that's totally natural farm or something like that. But they're trying to diversify in some other things, some additional income, yes.
Another theory I've seen out there is milk is being hit by quote milk products, you know, the soy milks, the almond milks, the plant-based milk-like products. Is that really having an impact here in Wisconsin?
Well, we don't sell as much milk for Fluid, but nationwide, the Fluid consumption keeps on declining due to those type of products. Other things is we don't eat breakfast cereal anymore and put milk on it. It's a factor, you know. So we keep on having a decline. So today, nationwide, only about 25% of the milk goes for drinking anymore. Over 50% goes in cheese. So the Fluid sales go down, cheese grows. So total-wise, total milk sales have increased because cheese is offset the declining Fluid milk sales.
And I understand cheese, obviously big in Wisconsin. I've heard we're also very big on a particular market, cheese for frozen pizza. That's a big thing here in Wisconsin?
Well, absolutely. I mean, pizza constitutes a large share of that cheese. But the other thing is we make over 600 different types of cheeses in Wisconsin. But the young people and other people, snacks and things of this sort. So cheese is being used in a variety of ways. But cheese, of course, pizza and cheese, of course, a big one.
So we've seen this decline in the number of dairy operations. As we wrap up, dairy is still going to be a big deal in Wisconsin for the foreseeable future?
I think we'll be there. We'll be number one in cheese and close to in in milk production. California keeps on declining a little but not growing. A lot of the advantage to producing milk has come back to Wisconsin. We can raise the feed, things of this sort, the climate, et cetera, and a strong cheese industry keeps our dairy industry viable.
Bob, thanks a lot for joining us again. Bob Kropp is Professor Emeritus of Agricultural and Applied Economics at UW-Madison. We talked to him today about new numbers showing a record loss in Wisconsin dairy herds in 2019. Coming up, we'll take a look at Charlie Brown, Snoopy, and the rest of the Peanuts gang and how they helped shape the lives of some well-known writers and artists. And you can share your favorite Peanuts memories. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new bill is seeking to limit the maximum interest rate charged on a payday loan in Wisconsin. We'll talk to a sponsor of that bill and find out how payday lending affects us here in the state. Now, did you watch A Charlie Brown Christmas at some point over the holidays? Did you watch it multiple times? In its two airings on ABC last month, more than 9 million viewers tuned in to see Linus explain the true meaning of Christmas by reading from the Gospel of Luke.
"Ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men."
What is it about Charlie Brown and the rest of the Peanuts gang that has people coming back for more? It's not just the big holiday TV specials, but the 18,000 daily comic strips as well. More than 30 well-known writers and artists, including Jonathan Franzen, Janice Shapiro, and Ira Glass, talk about the ways Charles Schulz's creations affected their lives and careers. Those sentiments make up a new book called The Peanuts Papers, Writers and Cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy and the Gang, and the Meaning of Life. Andrew Blauner is the editor of the new book. He's founder of Blauner Books Literary Agency. His other anthologies include Coach, Brothers, The Good Book, and more. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
This was a long-running comic strip. A lot of people, myself included, grew up on it. Why do you think Peanuts and Charlie Brown and Snoopy have had this enduring popularity?
Well, first of all, I'm stunned from the previous segment that there are 600 types of cheese being made
Wisconsin.
I say that sitting here in the middle of Midtown Manhattan, and full disclosure, I'm a recovering vegan. The secret of the peanut success, that was part of my agenda in putting this book together. It was to try to find some answers to that, because here we are 70 years removed from the start of Peanuts in 1950, 20 years removed since the time we had an original comic strip, because that's when Charles Schulz died in 2000. And there is something unquestionably transcendent, timeless, democratizing about it, starting from presidents from Obama to Reagan down to people at the local bar or barbershop. It seems to be something that people who maybe don't agree on anything else can agree that they love Peanuts. And within that, different people have their own affections and alienations and antagonisms about it. So I don't think there's any conclusion other than it begs a question of whether we're kind of in a new Peanuts moment. And I know I'm talking to people in the Midwest, in Wisconsin, and people have sort of theorized on whether it's a coincidence or not that there is kind of a renaissance of interest in Schulz and Peanuts, and also in Mr. Rogers. And they're both Midwestern guys who created these iconic, anthemic worlds that people many, many years later are still endeared by, learning from, and engaged with. So it's still a bit of a mystery, but it's a charming, life-affirming one, I think.
A running theme from a lot of the contributors to this book is that Peanuts wasn't light and funny and happy in many cases. There's a melancholy. Charlie Brown often starts the strip by saying, "I'm depressed." And he really is. He's dealing with depression and anxiety, and so are the other characters. What about this kind of bleak landscape captured us?
I think the notion is that there was something, because people have said, well, it was actually, to what you're saying, people said, well, was Peanuts actually kind of dark, especially for a comic strip? And Chris Ware, who created Jimmy Corrigan, among other things, you know, said in one of the panels related to this book, said, you know, I'm not sure it's about being dark so much as about being real. That until Peanuts came along, comic strips were mostly kind of populated by grown-ups who were acting like children. Here, the entire universe and the entire population of the strip was children. No grown-ups. Somebody pointed out that Snoopy is the only one whose parents ever actually appear in the strip. But there's no question about it that there's a melancholy to it, and there's probably no question that that's not coincidental with the fact that Schulz himself, you know, suffered from being melancholy himself. But, you know, one of the themes is unrequited love. I mean, everyone is in love with somebody who basically doesn't love them back, which is, Schroeder and Lucy and Sally and Linus and Charlie Brown and the little redheaded girl. But, you know, the themes of life is hard and people are difficult. But the flip side of that is, you know, perseverance has its value, and there's joy, you know, Snoopy's joy and wonderment. And for every disappointment, there's redemption. And, you know, if Linus is in the pumpkin patch, and you mentioned the TV specials, which was obviously a lot of people's gateway, if you want to call it that, to the world of Peanuts, you know, was Linus sitting in the patch waiting for the great pumpkin? Was that an act of faith, or was that naivete? I was struck listening to that intro you played of how much Linus in that great soliloquy sounds almost exactly like my 5-year-old son. Anyway,
yeah, and it seems like you know, as you mentioned, this is kids acting like grown-ups. In a way, this could be a safe place in a culture that maybe didn't want to talk about our individual mental health. We could see it lived out and tackle our own issues by watching these kids with big round heads.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, Charlie Brown, you know, never got a Christmas card. I mean, a Valentine's card, excuse me, which I learned in the process of putting this book together engendered mass number of people actually sending Valentine's cards to Charlie Brown
right.
through the Schultz office. So yes, it gave children, I think, a lot of, I mean, it was all sort of unconscious. I don't think as kids we were sort of having this conscious thought, but it kind of validated our lives and the meaning of our lives and the experiences that we had. There's also the element that it wasn't actually constructed and contrived to be something for children. It was Peanuts was, you know, put together by and actually Schultz, as many people may know, he detested the title Peanuts. He thought
right.
it was demeaning. you know, he would have just as soon called it Charlie Brown. And if you asked Schultz, you know, in his private life, you know, what is it you do? He said, oh, I draw that strip with Charlie Brown and Snoopy. He wouldn't even say the word Peanuts. That's how strongly he felt against it.
Talking to Andrew Blauner, editor of the new book, The Peanuts Papers, Writers and Cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy and the Gang and the Meaning of Life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us the role Charlie Brown and his friends played in your life, maybe your favorite character. We asked around here at WPR. Jennifer Dargan, network assistant director, says, I love the way they did the voice of the teachers on the TV specials. It really connected with me as a kid, how I felt about being on a totally different wavelength than adults. And adults appear very close to almost never or to never in the strips. They don't even have a voice in the specials. This is just the kids. What was up with that, Andrew?
Well, it's funny that a lot of people love that sort of teacher voice in the background. And Rick Moody, who's in the book, who's probably best known for writing The Ice Storm, has a great phrase for that. I think he calls it the trombone voice, mm-hmm. Sort of offset. This was a rare case of where it was all – I mean, and also you had no idea how old these kids were. I mean, and their parents were not around. They didn't really even have much furniture. You didn't know – they were obviously in suburbia, but we didn't know where. You know, a lot of it was about friendship and about getting along and about cruelty, obviously, with Lucy. And, you know, Ronald Reagan was on record that his favorite part of the whole strip was the, you know, Lucy pulling the football away from Charlie Brown. And people asked Schultz, well, couldn't you have just let him kick it once? And he said, no, it wouldn't be as funny or wouldn't keep people's interest. And then the gag would be over.
Now, let's talk about the art a little bit. Very minimalist, but a couple of the cartoonists in your book, and I've seen this elsewhere, they say, you know what, as simple as it looks, it's really hard to fake. You can't draw these kids like Charles Schultz did.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. The book that I put together before this one was about the Beatles, and there's sort of an analog there that I think a lot of people grew up, you know, singing or playing an instrument and thinking, how hard could it be? And you know, the drawing, you're right. Charlie Brown, Snoopy, there is a simplicity. I mean, there's a paradox to Peanuts. There is a simplicity, yes, to the art and to the drawing and also to the characters and the storyline. At the same time, it's complicated and the drawing is not replicable not nearly as much as it seems to be. And the storylines and the characters obviously have a lot more depth and complexity than you might think on the surface. But yes, I made a conscious effort to include several cartoonists writing prose in this book. There are no Peanuts strips themselves reproduced in the book, but there are some artists who have written strips, original strips of their own, but also written contributed essays. And it was fascinating to read their accounts. And somebody like a Chris Ware says, every cartoonist in the world owes a debt to Charles Schultz. And some people would go further than that and say we all, those of us who've loved it and learned from it and grown from it, owe that debt.
A lot of people, just briefly, a lot of people, not just cartoonists, engage in your book very seriously with the meaning yeah. of Charlie Brown. This is clearly in some ways more than a comic strip, right?
Well, yeah. And one of the surprises to me, one of my apprehensions going in was almost that, oh, everybody's going to write about Snoopy and how much they love him. and that was far from the case. In fact, I had no idea of how much – wasn't a backlash, but like a lot of people thought that Snoopy was a narcissist and that, you know, toward the the latter half of the strip, that it just became too much about his Baroque behavior. And on the flip side, I can't say I was aware of how much love there is out there for Charlie Brown and how many people, identified with him.
Talking to Andrew Blauner. He's editor of the new book. It's called The Peanuts Papers, Writers and Cartoonists on Charlie Brown, Snoopy, and the Gang, and The Meaning of Life. His other anthologies include Coach, Brothers, The Good Book, and more. This new book out looking at Charlie Brown and Charles Schulz. We asked our WPR colleagues about Charles Schulz and the Peanuts comic strips. Morning show producer Colleen Leahy says, I can recall from memory a comic that illustrates perfectly why I love Peanuts. Linus is looking at his hands, marveling that human hands have made brilliant compositions, sculptures, and written books. Then Lucy says to him as he's looking at his potential-filled hands, they've got jam on them. And marketing director Jeffrey Potter says, maybe what I appreciate most about the strip is that I find nuances in the punchlines and storylines that have changed meanings for me depending on where I am in my life. As an adult, I can relate to Charlie Brown on so many levels. You can chime in with your favorite Peanuts comics and how they've affected your life. Join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a particular comic strip that you've held on to for one reason or another? Which Peanuts character is your favorite or the one you relate to the most and why? Have you learned lessons in your life from the Peanuts gang? Do you share the comics and specials with your kids and or grandkids? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll be back with Andrew Blauner and take your calls. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.